So then the question is, how could reasonable people come forth with such very different solutions to a problem which they all admitted existed, and which they all admitted the United States should do something about, that we were in a position to do something about it?
We are, you see, at a very peculiar moment in history.
The old framework broke.
I'm trying to understand the evil that's abroad.
Science itself
now we
has become
bigger problems than ever before.
But we are conserving literally.
It's impossible to care for each other more.
What must be done
than we care
to
for the overcome
yet?
Now we see all the points.
Literally, for our survival on the planet, we have to learn.
There is no learning
without love,
the way of life.
It is the small community, not the same.
I belong here. I am part of this body. We are one together.
Back to talking to trees.
Children could build on our shoulders rather than out of our
back realizing that everything is
alive. Upon the earth as being with us, not for us.
On a rocky outcropping off the northeastern coast of England, the monastery of Lindisfarne once stood as an outpost of religious, philosophic, and intellectual study against the dark times of medieval Europe. Inspired by the foresight and dogged determination of these medieval monks, William Irwin Thompson founded the Lindisfarne Association in 1972 to gather together both scientists, scholars, artists, and contemplatives to realize a new planetary culture in the face of the political, cultural, and environmental crises of the 20th century. The Lindisfarne tapes represent some of the most visionary thinking of the time, drawing connections between culture, economics, society, and technology. While the germs of new ideas contained in these tapes are now beginning to take root, they remain an invaluable source of speculative thinking that will continue to inspire our visions of a more just and regenerative future. In this Lindisfarne lecture, Donella Meadows, co-author of Limits to Growth, talks about some of the contradictory priorities and the assumptions about reality which underlie and confuse policymaking.
I think the program says something about the global food problem, and that may have arisen, I'm not quite really sure, because of a paper which both Saul and Bill have gotten copies of through the Underground Press, which I wrote on the global food problem. I have it here, and I'm going to talk from it, but I'm not really going to talk about what's in it so much as the process that led to it. Because it's really a new departure for me, and I'm experimenting in the paper with ways of approaching or bringing together the policy world and the ethical value world and seeing if there's any way they can talk to each other. The paper started with a conjunction of two events in my life. One was I was asked to teach a course on environmental ethics, a subject which I was totally unqualified to say anything about, having never taken a philosophy course or read an ethics book in my life. The other event was that I was asked to write a paper for the State Department on U.S. policy toward the world food problem in the medium term, being defined by the State Department as 5 years. And so I was thinking about these two things simultaneously. How do you teach ethics? Especially with regard to environmental problems, and how do you tell the State Department what it can do in 5 years about the world food problem? And these things were rattling around in my head, and I tried some experiments, which is the only way I ever learned anything. With regard to teaching the ethics class, what I evolved was something which I think will come as no surprise to most of you who know more about these things than I did anyway, at least when I finally announced to an ethics professor at Dartmouth how I had blundered into teaching the class, he said, "Oh, yes, that's the way we always do it," and yawned. Anyway, it was a great discovery to me. What I did was first start with the hardest problem I could find and present it to the class, the hardest ethical current problem I could find, and that was the world food problem and the United States relative surplus and what one does with that surplus. So we started by reading what everybody I could find had to say on the subject. We read Garrett Hardin, and we read the Paddocks, and we got triage and lifeboat ethics and read that side. We read all the people reacting to that, essentially arguing purely on an ethical basis. That is an unethical set of arguments and setting forth alternate policies. We read Butts and Kissinger and Ford. on what was actually being done. That was sort of somewhere in there in the middle. And the first thing the students started becoming was, A, confused, because, of course, they're taught to believe everything they read, and they were reading things that contradicted each other. And second, they began asking, how can people see things so very differently? How can there be so many different opinions that are so completely contradictory? And if you were the policymaker sitting in the middle, what are you supposed to do? Well, I was still winging my way through the course and not knowing what was going to come next, so I said, let's look at that. How do these people have come to all of these different ideas? And we started with an assumption, which you may or may not be willing to grant, but which I enforced on the class, and that was that all the people on all the sides of the argument were reasonable, rational, essentially good, or at least not evil people. We couldn't just dismiss one or another argument by saying they're just fascists, or they're just politicians, or they're just stupid. We guaranteed that we were going to assume that they were all trying very hard and the best way they could to understand the problem, and that they came up with these conclusions because of some process which we were going to respect. Now, that was important. Without that, the whole course would have fallen apart. So that's the assumption underlying this discussion today, too. So then the question is, how could reasonable people come forth with such very different solutions to a problem which they all admitted existed, and which they all admitted the United States should do something about, that we were in a position to do something about it? Well, then that led us, conveniently, to the whole concept of, well, a lot of concepts, which, in fact, I had wanted to get across in the class. One was the different time horizons that people were looking from. And some people, particularly, let's say, Garrett Hardin, was looking at a kind of long biological, ecological sweep of maybe 200, 300 years in addressing the problem. Earl Butz clearly couldn't have been looking more than 6 months ahead if you read his statements. And there were a lot of other people in different positions. And automatically, we then began discussing where did these time horizons come from? An awful lot of them are institutionally imposed. A lot of others arise out of a discipline. The fact that Hardin is a biologist tells you something about his inherent time horizon. If we had any geologists in the argument, which we didn't, I presume the time horizon would have been 20,000 years or 20 million, which would have put the whole thing in a different perspective entirely. So we started asking, where do time horizons come from? And that became interesting. We at least understood why Ford, Butz, and Kissinger were all in one camp together with a certain set of constraints on them, fixing their time horizon at a certain place. I also put forth to them my 5-year assignment for the State Department and asked the students to help me write the paper, which they did. And I explained to them why that was the time horizon that was forced on us and what kind of conclusions we would come forth with if we were only looking at what could be done in the next 5 years. Okay, that didn't help entirely. We understood different time horizons, but there were still problems. There were vast disagreements on the facts. You could find one camp quoting facts and another camp quoting others that seemed to be contradictory. And there was a problem. There wasn't even a database that we could tell ourselves we could rely on. Since then, I read the Science article that says Ray Ravenholt is going around the world changing all the census statistics so that the population growth looks like less than it really is. I didn't know that at the time, or I would have introduced that little piece of evidence into the fact that we can't really trust facts, numbers, statistics, and so on. We have to reason things through as best we can, knowing there's going to be uncertainty. So we started talking about facts and what caused people to pick out different facts and quote different facts and believe different sets of numbers. Why does Ravenholt want to believe the world population growth is decreasing? Why do other people like Hardin want to believe that it's increasing? That got us to really, the word I use is models, but you might use paradigms or worldviews, or there's a whole set of words to express that. What are the underlying assumptions about the system that these different camps were using? And that was hard because they were never expressed in their written documents any more than the time horizons were explicitly expressed. We had to dig it out from the statements. They were essentially saying what to do. They weren't saying why they thought that should be done. And we had to assume that. And in some cases, I could be helpful. I knew Hardin. We had read Forrester, and I knew him. So I could fill in a little background about what I thought those people's worldview was. And we started trying to reconstruct them. And we did that by using systems theory, not in a quantitative sense at all, and not using the computer, because most of the students in the class didn't know anything about the computer, but just using essentially very simple system diagrams. I'll just demonstrate. There's a lot of them in here. I'll show you one very simple one that we constructed to explain the United States Department of Agriculture's worldview on the world food problem. Very simple diagram. In the middle is food price, and over here we have supply, and over here we have demand. And essentially, this is really what we came to call, what came to be called in the paper, the Western market model of the world food situation. Supply goes higher, the price goes lower. Never mind what the signs mean, I just put them up because I'm compulsive. Demand goes higher and price goes higher. This is really pure Keynesian, or even earlier than Keynesian, economic theory. The price goes up, the supply goes up, because there's more profit, more people come to the market, and so on. Any of you who've read Samuelson or Basic Economics Text have heard this, if you haven't seen this diagram. As the price goes up, the demand goes down, because people simply can't buy as much, or don't buy as much anyway. That's the Western free market competitive model of the situation. And of course, the world food problem in this model is defined as, how do you balance the supply and the demand? And the answer in this model is, the market does it for you. You don't have to do anything. Suppose demand gets a little higher than supply, which is, of course, the problem at the moment. Well, then all that happens is demand gets high, so the price goes up, so people buy less. That fixes it on one side. And also the price goes up, so people grow more, and that fixes it on the other side. And in fact, this is the Western economic model. You can almost read those statements word for word in the statements of Don Paarlberg, who's the chief economist for the USDA, or in Earl Butz's statements before the World Food Conference. You hear this model, or at least you hear things that are derived from this model. Essentially, it says the mechanisms are already there in society to fix the problem. All you have to do is let them work. You have to get out of interfering with the market. You have to let prices fluctuate, which they will in this model, and they recognize that, and that creates a few short-term hardships. But essentially, the system's okay. You don't have to make any very big changes. Those are equilibrating mechanisms. In my language, those are both negative feedback loops that are pulling the system so that supply and demand balance. There are walls on this side, too. And in fact, the environmentalists recognize the walls here. Supply doesn't come out of the air. It comes out of the land. And there are diminishing returns to using that land. And the more you're trying to get more and more supply out of it, the higher the price gets. And so essentially on this side, you can also push supply up so high that it's so costly to push it higher that there's a limit on this loop as well. That is, high price at some point won't bring forth more supply. That loop gets broken. In fact, really, I suppose if I could simplify the environmentalist and the socialist arguments, the environmentalists are looking here. It's not only land, it's water and energy and a lot of other things. And all of these are limits, walls, which prevent this loop from working someday, somewhere. They're limiting factors. The environmentalists are concerned, centering their view, their model, around that. The socialists are more concerned with exactly this side and saying that there's some subsistence amount of demand, and that's a wall you can't go below, which limits this part of the model. They're also very concerned with distribution, which is completely buried in these very aggregate arrows, and the fact that demand may not be distributed evenly simply because cash isn't distributed evenly, and cash is the thing by which one demonstrates one's demand. So distribution is essentially another limiting factor, at least the socialists would say, at the moment that is the limiting factor. There is enough food. It's simply that an awful lot of people aren't given the means to get their share of it. And if we could just change this, then this whole system could work again. It's just that it's so close for India, where people spend 80% of their income already on food. They're not, if food price doubles, they're out. So this system won't work until you redistribute, preferably the means of production, but if not that, at least the results of production. That's very simple, much simplifying those two arguments. In fact, I've simplified all three of those arguments so far. There's a more complex version in the paper. But really, the environmentalists are focusing here, the socialists are focusing there, the market economists are focusing in the middle. And the fourth argument is really perhaps a combination of these, and that's what I call the demographic transition argument. And that brings one more factor into demand, and that's population. Something the environmentalists are also very worried about, and by the way, so are the socialists. The socialists say that gives us labor, which gives us more supply. And so it's no problem. Every new mouth is born with two new hands attached. And there's no... Essentially, the socialists talk about population not as a limit, not as an increase in demand, but as an increase in supply. And they're right. Every one of these arguments, as far as I can tell, is right. The Malthusians only look at the mouth and not the hands and say what population does is increase demand and make that side worse. You have to supply more in order to get the same per capita standard of living. The demographic transitionists have a very dynamic view of population, which essentially says the system will fix itself because I don't have room to put the whole diagram up. But essentially, as economic development increases, that's an engine right here. I guess I can fit it in, at least a piece of it. I'll just call it development. It probably really means capital, which capital can increase the supply, and it also simultaneously decreases at least the rate of population growth, not the total population, eventually evening it off. That is, we all know that rich countries have lower birth rates than poor, that poor people have children because they need them, because the economic system makes it necessary for them to have them in order to really to keep a family business going, and so on. There's a long series of arguments there. They were very obvious in the UN Population Conference. And essentially, that's the argument there. Development solves both sides of the loop, both problems at once. It increases supply, and it levels off demand. Okay. There are more arguments than that. They are all more complex than that, and I don't think if you want to, we can go deeper into each one of them. It took quite an effort to even identify those four and to make them clear and to put them down on paper and for us all to understand them. And as we did so, we realized, you know, of course everybody in the class had taken sides from the beginning, including me, but as we began to identify the four arguments, we realized that we really had no complaint against any one of them. That the things they were talking about were there. They weren't flaws. They weren't imaginary. There was a market. It could work. There was the contribution of labor to production, and there was the increase in population, making it more difficult to increase per capita supply. All of that was right. All four of those positions were right. The final problem that we began to realize was they were each just part of the system. Each group of people was focusing on a piece and thinking that was all. And so what we did was stick the four models together, which is roughly what I've done up there. There's more to it than that. And we tried, and this is a very difficult mental exercise, especially when you start out on one side or the other, which we all do, every one of us does. We try very hard to see all four at the same time. It kind of blows your mind. You have to sit there and stare at it, and you have to think about it, and you have to drag yourself away from the part you like best and recognize the other parts are there. It was helped in the class by the fact that we were scattered. There were different members of us wanting to zero in on different systems. We kept each other honest. At any rate, we ended up with an enormous diagram. It was much bigger than that and much more detailed, trying to say this is the whole thing, or at least as much of the whole thing as any of the various arguers seem to have identified. And we were, at the end, we got pretty satisfied with that model. We never put it on, we could have put it on the computer at that point. We didn't, we never have. But it was really a think piece, trying to understand what everybody was saying. So we got the whole model and we said, now we should be able to make policy. Now we see all the points of view and we've got them all together and they're not inconsistent. Surprise. So we should be able to get some sort of consensus out of what to do, because now we agree on what the problem is and what the system is. And of course, we didn't agree. And we came up with a lot of different policies and they weren't the same. We were still arguing. And of course, what finally came out of that was different ones of us had different priorities in the values that we were trying to make the system exhibit, or the direction we were trying to make it go, or the goal, or what we were hoping would be the future state of the system. I mean, we all agreed there should be more food and that there shouldn't be starvation and things like that. That was easy. That's simple. Everybody agrees on that. But below that, there are so many trade-offs, and in order to gain this, you have to give up that. And the model began making those trade-offs painfully clear. So we were more aware, perhaps, than we had been before of how our values had to be ordered to get one result versus getting another result. So we started fighting about values. And the first thing we tried to do was list our own in order of priority, separately from the food system or how we wanted that policy to come out, to just try to list them. That's impossible. I don't know if you've ever tried to do that. It's really hard to look inside yourself and look at the kinds of policy decisions you prefer over the other kinds you prefer, and to make a list, and then just to make a list, and then make it in order of priority. Just for interest, I finally put one in the paper that I identified as mine, and I still think it is, although I change it from time to time. And the list I put up is the one there on the right. I left that one up from last night. I wasn't here when that one went up, so I'm not quite sure what it's intended to express, whether it's a priority list or whether it's just a list. But it was interesting, so I kept them juxtaposed. But this was the list I finally decided expressed my value system in order of preference. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These little arrows here show my ambiguity, because it's really, this is another thing I discovered accidentally and by surprise, it's a sliding dynamic list. That is, survival is number one, period. That is, survival of the whole system, not just people, but everything. Material welfare is number two. That is, I don't see any point in surviving in poverty. So at least enough to eliminate the grinding concern for the next day's meal. But at some point, material welfare has to go down to the bottom of the list. That is, at some welfare level, then I'm no longer concerned about that as number two. Okay? So this is a dynamic thing that slides down there when welfare gets up a certain point. And of course, that point is sliding and dynamic, and we would disagree about that. But let's just say for the moment, there's some point at which this goes to the bottom of the list, but below that point, it's number two. Is that clear? Three is equity. And again, it doesn't mean pure, absolutely equal on every line equity. And so within some degree of slide, I'm willing to let that go down further, just so we're within some tolerance limit. Okay? Gross inequity puts it up that high, but slight inequities would move it down, because I would put freedom higher at that point. This is very difficult, very hard to define those points, to say how this scale moves. And I'm not expecting you to agree with this list either. I'm only putting it up as an illustration. I think it really helps. We found it helped through the rest of the course, the discussion, for everybody to be as aware as possible of everybody else's value system, not to tear it apart or anything, but just to know from what underlying position that person is speaking. Freedom came for, and efficiency defined the way the market economists define it, and it's number one on most of their lists. That is essentially trying to get the most output for the least input. And of course, they're only talking about one kind of input, labor. If I only talk about labor, I put it here. If I start talking about the most output for all the inputs, including resources, energy, capital, and so on, I'm not sure that I would, well, I guess it still would be five. It would be below freedom. That's my list, and you might be thinking about what yours is, because if we get into policy, which I expect we will in a minute, changing that list a little really changes the policy emphasis. Yeah?
I was just questioning efficiency as belonging in that list at all, because I would view that it's a means, not an end in itself.
Yeah.
And that it's related to all the others.
I'm not at all sure those things are parallel. And the only reason I put it up there was because I saw it so dominating some other people's value systems, especially people in the course. And that's undoubtedly why it's last on my list. I think it isn't quite parallel to the others.
I would have thought there might be a misunderstanding on the student's part.
Could be.
Between me and me.
Could very well be.
Because they may think of it as a way of achieving.
But in fact, if you go back to that little Western market model, and the reasons people justify that, efficiency is the thing that's always mentioned. In fact, it's usually the only thing that's mentioned. That's a terrible... that little model is a terrible producer of equity. I mean, it's a great producer of inequity. And equity is never mentioned as a value when you're talking about that system. And so I put it up there more as a foil, because I thought other people thought it was important, and perhaps they were confusing the two, and that may be the source of a lot of our problems.
I think those that believe that the pure economic model, the Friedman kind of school, would believe that that achieves equity too. I would question that assumption, but I think that they may think that it could very well be.
Dennis?
Actually, each of those is to some extent a strategy for achieving the ones above it. I
mean, yeah.
As you said, it's sort of material welfare is useful to you to the extent that it gets you up above the survival concerns to higher.
In fact, that whole list, really, it could be defined as means to yet a higher end than any of those things. Any other comments at this point?
Does leaving efficiency in make you look at how you use the world around you, whereas the others might not?
Perhaps. You get into a real problem with defining all those words, but particularly that one. And if I define it as the ratio of inputs to outputs, you know, if you think of some of the points that Schumacher made in Buddhist economics, he regards that as a high value in a Buddhist economic society is to get the most output per input. But there, they're not just talking about human labor input. They're talking about, you know, essentially nature, input of nature.
That's what I meant.
Yes.
When I said it might be, we'll keep it in if we're sure what we're
yeah.
doing.
Yeah. Another nice thing about these discussions is you have to start defining these things more carefully, which is a useful thing to do, because you find yourself speaking a little less puzzly than you were before, and perhaps communicating better. I hope so. At least the class started communicating better as a result of all this. Yes?
This seems like it's such a sensible priority list. Do you remember the least sensible one from your point of view?
It's what you just said was your priority list is the same as this.
I can't imagine being very far off.
Yeah.
But can you remember?
Yes. I can remember some people arguing very strongly that equity was the top thing on the list, and without it, survival wasn't worth the candle. And that was not, as far as I could see, these lists are not negotiable. We couldn't convince each other, and we stopped trying. We just realized that person or those groups of people thought equity was number one, and they were going to sacrifice other things in order to get that. Whereas, I could argue, and I will argue, why I made the list this way, and I think it's very rational. But of course it isn't.
Who's equity?
Pardon me?
Who's equity? What does equity mean?
Okay, very good. We got into that too. That's why I had to make it sliding. You know, essentially, it means not even equal, but just distribution of all of the things that people think are important, all right? And just meaning to the point where nobody is terribly upset about the way it is. Okay, it does not mean equality, absolute pathological equal distribution of every single scarce good and service. Because, for one thing, people even have different values and desires with goods and services, so it isn't pure equality. But it's distribution that's sufficiently fair that nobody feels terribly outraged on either side, the ones who have more or the ones who have less. I think probably, you know, there probably has never been an equitable society that has realized that goal, so it's hard to define it or point to it anywhere. But as long as somebody really feels he's got the short end of the stick, then I would say that's not an equitable society.
An important aspect of this value hierarchy is the time dimension, which isn't made explicit here. And you know, it's not only important to know what kinds of trade-offs you're willing to make between, say, equity and material welfare at the moment, but, for example, how much material welfare you will forego now in order that you can have, say, survival or equity or freedom over the longer term. And people, of course, differ very substantially in the length of the trade-offs that they're willing to entertain. Yes. Some thinking that if they can't have equity right now, then they're willing to say forego survival. Others being willing to sacrifice for a generation or two in order to put in place the foundations for a just society that will exist in the future. Did your class get off into any attempt to quantify or make explicit the time trade-offs that they had associated with this list?
We got tangled up in that a lot. I'm not sure we solved that problem. What I thought we were going to do as we worked this out, you see, was make a very neat division among all these things, time horizons, the model or the sort of underlying assumptions about the nature of the system, and the values or the priorities of the values. I thought we could keep those categorized neatly and discuss each one rationally and then put it all together. And of course that didn't happen. For one thing, it became obvious very quickly that I'm not sure what comes first, the model or the value, and I don't think they come separately. That is, people with certain priority lists had certain models. And there was a very good correlation there, at least among members of the class, and also apparently, as far as we could tell, among the people whose opinions we were reading, whether the values cause you to choose a certain model because they cause you to see certain things in the world and not see others, or whether it works the other way around, I'm not sure. I think they're just intertwined. Wherever one gets one's values from, and that's, of course, all human experiences, it creates your model. It cause if your primary concern is survival, as it was on my list, you begin to see all the threats to survival. And you maybe don't see the threats to equity quite as strongly because it's only number three on your list instead of number one. And so what we finally ended up being was confused about really how whether those things are separate. I think we decided they weren't, but where they come from and how they evolve in one person's mind, I have to say, is still a mystery to most of us. All we really managed to do was to get it out where other people could look at it. And in fact, see it in ourselves more clearly than we did. Then we had to end up trying to... I think what we ended up doing was understanding why it's so hard to make a policy. Because any policy freezes a model and a set of values and says that is what we are going to believe about the world and these are the things we are going to strive for in the following order. And when you have a diverse population that doesn't agree on those things, somebody is going to be outraged. Yeah.
Would the national interest be a value in the sense of
it wasn't in...
Because this would obviously come up
yes.
last in Kissinger.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't even get on my list at all. It certainly would have been on theirs.
Yeah, but I mean, how would they consider within the frame of reference?
Sure.
Right.
There's something about, I don't know whether you mean national security or national status or what, but those things are certainly in their thinking.
Yeah.
And they weren't in ours. We were, of course, being academic idealists about the whole thing.
And
right. Yeah. Oh, well, the policy we finally came up with, which I'll tell you about in a minute, it had no consideration of any political realities at all, as will become real. We were trying, really, to come up with policies that would lead to our values being realized, given our assumptions about the way the world was.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's, I think, the best anybody can do. Although we can argue about the values, and certainly the department found this paper totally unacceptable in every way.
Must be pretty good at
that. They just didn't consider it even relevant.
Right, exactly. For one thing, I rejected, we all, the class as a whole, got into your time horizon problem and rejected the 5-year limit. And we just said, in 5 years you can't do a damn thing about this problem. Now let's talk about the area within which you can really have an effect. And so we made a 100-year time horizon, which the State Department lost interest there. And we knew that was going to happen. I mean, we were really trying to learn more than we were trying to make policy. Yeah?
Just as a comment on the State Department's projection of the time horizon, I was at a meeting of the National Planning Association about 6 years ago, and I had an economist there who was he said he had estimated that the political discount rate on the future was 56%.
42%.
I don't know how he came up with that figure, but for those of you who aren't familiar with discount rates, that means that anything that's more than 2 years away doesn't exist.
Right. That's worse than Alice's corporate discount rates, which sounded to me like they were more like 20%.
25.
Yeah, okay. Which at least gives you a 4-year planning horizon or so. Roughly.
Well,
Dennis?
I find useful, though not to the extent that useful and confusing the issue even further, rather than leading you to a precise specification, the notion not only of chronological discount rates, but of geographical discount rates.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that you have this sort of threefold trade-off. For myself, or my reference group, how do I trade-off? At what point does it Do I have enough material welfare to start investing all my efforts in equity? And then there's this question about how am I going to make those trade-offs for my group over time? And finally, it's what's my group? And it's clear that I'm willing to tolerate a little bit of loss. Operation. We are willing to tolerate a good deal of loss of survival for groups over on the other side of the world in order to spend resources enhancing our own material welfare, equity, and freedom over here. So there's a So for some people, they don't care what's going on in the next neighborhood. For some people, they really identify with the nation. I suppose Kissinger, really, outside of personal life, does not differentiate between Kansas and Nebraska, and maybe he discriminates against California. But by and large, he doesn't have a high discriminant amongst the various states. He has signed that for equal value. Then there's a very big discount when you go across the border.
Sure.
And other people, probably your kids, were talking about this really from a global perspective, at least starting off with the idea that if an Afghani starving to death was as disturbing as an American starving to death.
Well, that led it back to an interesting class discussion when we finally hit on the concept of equity and started talking about it and where it fit on our list. Because some of the students who had equity at the top of the list, I would say at least half the class did, in fact, and we started talking about that, and they said, well, if you went to the Thayer Dining Hall, which was our campus meal place, would you get mad if every fourth person got a steak and the other three got rice and meal? You know, would that be inequitable? Well, it would not only be inequitable, it would be intolerable as far as they were concerned. That was not the kind of equity they could deal with. And I said, what would you do? And they said, well, if I got the steak, I'd share it with the others. And I said, now, what do you think is really going on in the world? One out of every four people is eating steak, and the other three are eating rice, and you're not out there sharing your steak. And that concept of being able to see the inequity, it's about sitting there at the same table with you, versus knowing that it's in your mind somewhere, that somewhere over in India, people are eating rice and you're eating steak. became very clear to them. In fact, I'm afraid an awful lot of them have become vegetarians as a result of this course. Well, I'm not afraid. I'm proud. Yeah.
You just mentioned the very words that Richard Leakey, for example, is the key to survival. He would put the list in a completely different way. And survival would be what it's all about. And one key word, that the only word that will ensure survival, or at least make survival possible, is sharing.
Yeah.
So that all these other things are perhaps...
That's necessary, but not sufficient.
Yeah. In fact, this was primarily the socialist argument of the four models we looked at. Distribution fixed that, and you fixed it. And I think probably distribution is the single thing in the short term that could do the most to solve the problem. It is assuming you could redistribute in the short term, forgetting the institutional barriers and the social barriers and so on. There's no question there's enough food in the world to feed everybody. In the long term, though, assuming that distribution only redistributes and doesn't change anything else in the system, you still run up against limits, finally, to the point if there isn't enough to distribute. You know, then you have a problem. So there's got to be... Distribution is a key, but it's not the only key. It's just one part of the picture.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sure. It brings up another point. There's a man who's just written a book, I can't remember his name, about survival in concentration camps. He made a long study of who survived and why, because there were many survivors. And he found that the people who did survive were those who were involved in sharing. That had nothing to do with how much, had nothing to do with the quantity they were sharing. It was the quality of the act. There were many people in concentration camps who managed to get for themselves a little more of this or that and could have physically survived, but they didn't.
Yeah.
But those who shared what infinitesimal amount of something they had were the ones who made it. So that's an interesting
thing. Yeah. I think distribution carries you a lot, redistribution, equitable distribution, carries you a lot further on any resource base than any other way of sharing the pie. But if the resource base is insufficient, if they had to live in the concentration camp for 50 years with less than a survival amount of food, sharing wouldn't have helped in the long run. They just wouldn't have been enough food.
But the sharing was more than just a physical thing.
Yeah,
it was,
sure.
It was a much broader, more philosophical thing than that.
So which enables you, in fact, probably even physiologically, to get by on less resource than you otherwise would. Not to mention the violence that may come from not equal sharing.
Might increase the food. Yeah. Sharing in an inelastic system is almost academic, though. Sharing in an elastic system, as in the case of the lunchroom, I mean, if you share in the lunchroom situation, you never solve the problem of why is the steak in front of one and the rice in front of the other three, you avoid that issue. If you, in the process of sharing, increase the population because more can survive, you now reach the point where survival again becomes an issue. In the prison situation where you have a fixed population, I think that's quite a different situation.
Sure. That's the environmentalist piece of the model. That the population is dynamic, it's not static. The resources somewhere are limited, not now, but sometime in the future. And this again is a short-term, long-term problem. In the short term, sharing works, will work, and we're not quite sure how long it would continue to. But if that's done, and nothing is done about the limited resource base and the increasing demands, then at some point that policy breaks down. Ultimately what we came out with in trying to work out a policy was something that involved all three of the possible policies. That is, no single one had the answer. And one of the troubles with these individual four models is each one comes out with one solution. And in fact, as far as we could figure when we looked at all the models and assumed they were all right, any one of those solutions alone was inadequate. The three basic things you can do about the food problem, and there are only three, is produce more food, distribute the food better, or decrease the demand for food by ultimately limiting the population or leveling off the population or convincing the population to eat less. Okay, so there's a supply policy, there's a demand policy, and there's a distribution policy. And I don't see that any one of them alone can do it, especially when we started putting numbers back in, figured out how long it would take that demographic transition, which is occurring, to work, and how many people that would produce in the world, and how much real production one could expect, and remembering that we have to produce other things besides food. If you mentally allocate all the world's resources to food, you don't see any food problem. But then you remember that people need other things besides food, and then you get back into the problem again. So what we ended up with was really a combination of a lot of those policies with different emphases through time, because, as I said, for example, distribution is very effective to begin with. It becomes less so if you don't add population limitations sometime. And increasing food supply is typically not something that can be effective right away because of the natural delay. You can't just double the food supply overnight. But it's something that over a longer haul can be done. At least there's latitude for a lot more yield increase and so on that has already been realized. But some balance of the three, and especially a canny balance through time, seem to us, and it's hard to really... I'm the sort of person who won't believe it until I do put it in the computer and see, because I know my mind might be playing tricks with me about how the numbers will work out. Anyway, we came down with some kind of more even emphasis on all three of those policies. If you look at the real policies that are being done by any government in the world, with the exception of China, perhaps, and North Korea and that group of countries, raising the supply is the only thing you see really being done. It seems to be a really incredible set of blinders. Food problem, raise more food. And that is the one that will drive the system toward those limits, the ultimate physical limits. And it's the one in my mental model of the way the system is that will threaten survival, which is my number one priority. So I'm upset about that policy by itself. Most of the people who advocate that policy don't see a threat in survival there. It's not in their model. That part of the model is missing, really. And so they're time horizon is so short that they're right in that time horizon. There is no threat to survival. Yep.
It has a strange parallel to the more weaponry model. It's also continued. You're threatened with more weapons, but overkill is a greater danger. I mean, it's non-productive to make more weapons. To make more food.
In the short term, it might be.
It's also identical to the energy thing. If you've got an energy problem, make more energy.
Yep.
Why is it a threat to survival? I don't understand. You raise more food, why is it a threat to survival?
That's really an ecological assumption. Raising more food requires spreading more fertilizer on the land and more pesticide, at least the way we think more food has to be raised now. It requires clearing land, it requires burning down forests, and so on. If you look at the countries that have really pushed that policy as far as they can, the threat to survival is almost already visible. And it's the threat to survival of the whole system, not just the human part of it. And, you know, for me, because I'm an eco-freak, that is the worst possible outcome, according to my value system. Yes.
But that need not disturb the methods of agriculture and horticultural unchanged.
Yes. In fact, let me get more explicit about that. The policies that we came up with were under these three categories: population control, redistribution, and raising more food. The raising more food policies will sound so familiar to all of you that I don't even need to argue them, but they're absolutely strange to the USDA. I mean, they are things like intermediate technology, organic methods, using natural systems, using more labor and less capital, and using more solar energy and less fossil fuel energy, and all of these things, which of course make absolute sense, right? And furthermore, can increase production, which this is the one part of the USDA's mental model. They really think that those methods will reduce output. Any of you who have an organic garden going, I went out and inspected yours this morning, and I see it's a really great one, know that that's not true. In fact, it could very well increase. It certainly won't decrease total output. And so we have a long section here trying to convince the State Department to go jump on the USDA for at least the tropical countries to learn new ways of raising food. You know, if we want to go ahead...
Which are really old ways.
Yeah. Although one can combine new knowledge with the old ways and go come out ahead of either of the current choices.
There are techniques, obviously, which would let us double or conceivably even triple the production of vegetable calories over what we have today without doing as much damage as we're currently doing to the ecosystem.
Yeah.
But there aren't any techniques that let you just indefinitely improve your food output.
No.
And at some point, the pressure for more food, irrespective of what techniques you're using, forces you into this region where you're making short-term, long-term trade-offs, because under any set of techniques, you have the option of investing in current production or in the maintenance of the ecosystem. And at some point, if pressure gets high enough, you start diverting resources and time and so forth that would go into the maintenance, off into the short-term production, and then the ecosystem starts to collapse. A lot of traditional societies have never heard of fertilizer and pesticides. Perfectly well succeed in collapsing their ecosystem using traditional techniques.
Yeah.
Like the Maya.
Like the Maya, like Fertile Crescent.
And that's why, ultimately, we had to come down pretty heavy on population policies of one sort or another. And in fact, those were the ones we thought were, in the short term, most important to start, simply because they're policies that take 50 years to show an effect. And if they're not started soon, there will be no chance of their being effective at all. And so there's quite a long section in here on that. There's also quite a long section on redistribution, primarily which concentrates on Americans eating less. Whether that's actively diverted out of our mouths and into the mouths of somebody who needs it or not, ultimately I think that has a good effect on the system. Again, I can't be sure of that until I really work it out. Yeah. You. Yeah.
Oh. You mentioned alternative production. Probably a lot of people here have already heard of it, but I got a study from Ecology Action of the Northern Peninsula, and they were measuring output, and they found that vegetable production by biodynamic techniques, etc., was up 300 to 400% over per square foot productivity over conventional farming, and water consumption was down to 25% of that, you know, per square foot than normal production. And a whole pile of other figures that I don't remember.
Any of us who have ever tinkered with that kind of thing know that. But the other thing I know from having tried to implement it myself in the wilds of New England is that those are very labor-intensive methods.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is good for many ways. I mean, there we're putting in renewable labor energy instead of non-renewable fossil fuel energy. We're creating the jobs which everybody seems to be crying out for. We are getting people back to a field for the land and lots of things, which I think are good, which the USDA doesn't. And they only look at labor efficiency. They don't look at water efficiency or land efficiency or capital efficiency or energy efficiency.
Well, labor efficiency is under the same techniques. It was labor intensive, but the
output
the
was
market
sufficient.
Wage of the labor was also attractive.
Sure.
Depending upon the product produced.
Yeah.
I should add one thing about that study. We can't extrapolate that even across the continent because it's carried out in one of the most favorable areas to produce that kind of result.
Yeah.
It's
still interesting. It's still a very interesting study.
Yeah.
I'm just very frightened that we extrapolate to the globe.
Very outstanding. Doing that, I was thinking that there's one way you can have the wheat belt remain the wheat belt, that means there's an awful lot of trouble.
Does it come in up here?
With all these variables, maybe this is just an intensely curious question. Could you lead us a little bit into where your policy conclusion did come to?
Come out, okay.
They got to be fascinating.
We all
can think of variables, but we'd love to know where
you
took your
pattern.
Well,
and I'm not sure we have proceeded exactly and without error from our assumptions and our values to our conclusion, I mean to our policy conclusion. But, you know, there may be some slips of the logic there, and maybe you can catch them. That bothers me that there may be. In the population thing, which we started with, this many of you are not going to like, we came out with something which looks, on the surface at least, very similar to what Hardin and Paddock and so on have been calling for, which is simply that death rates should not be lowered anywhere without birth rates being lowered very close to simultaneously. And if it can't be done, then keep them both high. That is really, with regard to aid policy, how you would implement that makes all the difference, as far as I'm concerned, as to whether it's moral or immoral, ethical or unethical. Essentially, if I could, I suppose, write the perfect policy, it would be the free choice of every nation which, or every subgroup within the nation, which of those options they prefer, high birth and death rates or low birth and death rates. But the one option that we will not at least help anybody out with is high birth rates and low death rates.
How do you achieve that?
I think, I don't know. I think you do it by not imposing either one on anybody. That is, not going in with vaccinators, vaccinating unconcerned and, in fact, suspicious people and forcing death control on anyone, or by going in and forcing birth control on anyone, but by saying they're both available. If you want them, we will supply them. You take both or neither.
Yeah, but if they take both, one will work and the other won't. The vaccinations work regardless.
Well, that depends.
Introducing population control has not.
That depends on how you introduce the population control and what the policy is there. If you just hand out purple condoms, which is the current method, they won't be used and nothing will happen. You're absolutely right. The babies are wanted and will be for a long time.
But it's not even.
Well, but no, if you give a tubal ligation or a vasectomy at the same time that you give a smallpox shot, then it does work.
Yeah, that's true.
I said, if you sterilize a person at the same time that you're not being inoculated, then it does work.
Okay, is that what you recommend?
As long as people know that's what they're getting and are asking for it and realize that, you know, it's both of those things or neither of those things. Now, that is very hard morally, ethically to defend. And I can't do so if that's the only piece of the policy. It's a very bad, I shouldn't have mentioned that one first, you see, because that alone I would not recommend. I think that's horrible if it were the only thing that we did. Another thing which I think is essential that we do is get our own population birth rate and death rate balanced first. That is, essentially do for ourselves first what we propose that others do and demonstrate how. We don't know how. It's much easier for us than it is for them, because they're closer to begin with. We've almost gone through the demographic transition. We've had our big period of high birth rate, low death rate. It's passed. We still have an immense population growth in this country. In fact, the number of people added per year by net increase in the United States is higher than it was in 1850, when we were at our maximum birth-death rate differential, simply because we're now multiplying that differential by 210 million people. Back then we were multiplying it by something, I don't remember exactly, 25 million or something like that. So we're adding 1,200,000 people per year by net increase, not counting migration, with a very small birth-death differential. And those 1,200,000, of course, are consuming from 5 to 60 times as much of everything per capita as the people in poor countries are. So I would say the first thing we do is get tough with our own population and get that straightened out so that it is not growing, perhaps even slowly declining, and then it simply don't interfere unless somebody asks us to outside. That is, stop imposing death control, stop imposing birth control, and let the nations themselves figure it out. Now, I think you'd be surprised. I was surprised. Since I've been thinking about this, I've been talking to people from the developing countries. I think you'd find about a number of them would choose the high death rate, high birth rate, and a number would choose the opposite. India is talking internally, its own idea, about coercive birth control. That's their decision. It isn't ours, and I don't think we should say that's moral or immoral. It's their decision. And how they impose it is their decision, and I'm not really happy with the Indian government or how it imposes anything. But this was a discussion that began long before the Indian government took its current form.
But your birth control method is sterilization.
It might be. That's one possibility. There are many others. Most of the, I think, the interesting ones deal with the reasons why people have children and provide an alternative to the necessary things which children do provide in those countries, like Social Security, you know, old age guarantees, labor for the farms. One of my students came out with an idea, which I think is terrific, for Bangladesh. They suggested that every son after the first be recruited at the age of 16 to a local kind of Peace Corps, that is all second, third, fourth, and so on sons, to go around and help farmers harvest their field in the harvest times for everybody. So there would be no longer any advantage in having those third, fourth, and fifth sons. You could get your help when you needed it anyway. And essentially the sons would be shared among the whole population. I mean, things like that, things that are very imaginative that might be much more acceptable in other cultures than they would be in ours.
That was an idea, by the way, of
believe, of Joseph Popper Winkius.
Really?
Who was Rosenthal Pussy's teacher, which led to the WBA.
Don't be a good boy, Rusty. Your hand is up.
Go ahead, Rusty.
And Governor Brown at present is thinking about a similar type of thing. Instead of, Winkius' idea was a war, an army of sustenance.
Yeah.
Rather than an army of the military army.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
James's moral equivalent of war.
Yeah.
And that led to the WPA, and now in California they're trying to think of the CCC, but it's sort of similar.
Then when we talk about the death birth rate discrepancy, that generally all the conversation drifts toward the birth side, control of birth, and I wonder whether it would be fairly interesting for the students or someone else to explore the concept of death and the lack of respect for death.
Yes.
And it seems to me that a great deal of progress could be made in a whole rethinking of the way in which we look at death.
Or at least a respect for the way other cultures look at it. I mean, we really automatically assume that infant mortality is bad. I mean, it's so deep in our culture that it's impossible for me to assume anything else. You know, I just when I was in those countries and saw small children with smallpox, my first reaction is, why doesn't somebody vaccinate them? But that wasn't the reaction of the people around me. And you know, I simply can't speak for those cultures.
Even forgetting infant mortality, which is sort of lack of technology that justifies it or whatever, but even thinking about our concepts of things such as suicide, or mature death, not
right.
infant mortality.
Yeah. There are certainly a lot of different opinions in the world about that. That whole population question is the hardest part, of course. And I think within this country, there are a lot of imaginative things, short of coercion, that haven't been done, and could be done. Simply declaring it as a goal, which the Rockefeller Commission recommended, 4 years ago, that we wouldn't even be disturbed if the population stabilized. Never really has been done, and at least a lot of that people have heard. So within our country, I think there are a lot of things that could be done. Within other countries, I think I would leave it to them to do things, but simply get across the idea and implement the idea in our own foreign policy that the choice of high birth rate, low death rate is an anti-ecological, anti-social, and in fact physically impossible in the long term choice, which will undermine any other aspect of the food policy. That is, if everybody really wants low death rates now and birth rates, let them do what they want to. In the long run, the other policies which we've put forth will be destroyed. So there's really no way, I think, out of that one. That's the ecological part of the model coming in. I think there is a problem, and I think it's a rather serious one, and I don't think it's going to solve itself. Now let's get to the policies that are nicer, because that's the not nice part, and it's tough. I don't see any way around it. The distribution policies are very interesting. Again, one can do lots of things, from proclaiming a revolution and redistributing land all around the world and so on. And I'm not sure we had an agreement in the class about how far one should go. It's simply that an awful lot of things could be done. A lot of it's already been being talked about, from emergency food aid to world food buffers. A lot of those things I think would be very effective. Pricing policies, changing the conditions of the world food market, and I understand that a little better now than I did at the time I wrote that paper, because I have seen, in fact, a computer model which finally made clear to me, the computer model didn't, but the verbal description of it did, some of the ways that the world food market screws the small countries and the poor importing countries. And some recommendations are coming forth now, which I think are based on an understanding of the system that nobody had before, about how really the market is allocating food from the poor to the rich very effectively, and how it could be changed. So there's a lot along those lines, and I won't go into it in detail unless you ask me to. We put in quite a lot about Americans eating less, using less, not only of food, but of energy, which goes into fertilizer and a lot of other things, which eventually could end up as food. So in other words, internal reduction of consumption. And again, we can get into lots of ways, both voluntary and coercive, that that could be done. You know, state taxes or something like that. We were talking about that at breakfast, and there are myriads of possibilities along those lines. And again, we could explore them as a group if you'd like to. I think that Americans reducing their consumption in the short term may have a bad effect, in the long term a good one. And in fact, it may be ineffective. That is, all it may mean is the wasting of some resources in this country, some land that wouldn't get plowed or some wood that wouldn't get cut and used or something like that. I think, though, if the world market were simultaneously made a little bit more realistic and effective, that wouldn't happen because the demand is certainly there. And if the wheat isn't grown for Americans, it could be grown for people elsewhere and would be if the world market price and the American export policies allowed it to be. So I do think in the long run, with some institutional changes, Americans consuming less would result in other poorer people consuming more, especially with grains, where we have such a monopoly on the market. So there are a number of internal suggestions. This is terrible to tell the State Department. In fact, most of our policies are domestic. You know, population should stabilize. Americans should be urged to consume less of things, and so on. And the state is another reason why this report is unacceptable to the State Department. They only want to tell other people what to do. I think, again, there's the simple fact of forming an image, as we were talking about this morning, Jerry Brown, by living a different way, in a very visible way, probably has much more of an effect than any legislation, thou shalt not consume something or another, would have. And if Americans as a whole didn't set forth a certain wasteful material lifestyle for the rest of the world to look at and ape, then I think the effect over the long term, not over the short term, would be striking. The food production policies I've already described roughly, and you know, we could go into detail, but particularly with our direct interference with other countries' ways of raising food, and we have immense interfering powers, all the way from John Deere's import arrangements with India, to U.S. aid policies, to the kind of seed strains we distribute, to the kind of agriculture we are teaching people to do, derived from our experience in temperate climates and our experiences in a cheap era of fossil fuel. Well, there's a lot of changes that need to be done there. And people like John, working with new ways of raising food and integrating systems and getting more from less and so on, I think the direction that has got to be gone there. And again, with regard to aid policy, an awful lot of humility and working an experimental approach to working out the food production problems of a specific country with a specific climate, soil, insects, and so on, experimentally with the people who are already growing food there, who many times know much more about it than we do. But nevertheless, some of our knowledge probably would be useful if it were combined with the traditional methods. That is, something could emerge that's not the way we do it, it's not the way they do it, but it's some fruitful combination of the two. I have a friend who's Persian. He spends 6 months of the year in the Population Institute in North Carolina and 6 months of the year in Iran. And he's all fired up to get the Shah to donate to a new international intermediate agricultural technology institute a great big piece of land he has up in the north of Persia, arid, very typical of the whole agricultural problem of the Middle East. And his idea would be to get there both the traditional methods and the modern methods together to work out something, you know, maybe irrigation, as it always has been done, underground. Iran is probably the most efficient irrigating nation in the world. They hardly lose a drop of water anywhere, but they do it with wooden shovels and mud tunnels and huge amounts of labor, and people get killed because the things collapse and so on. A combination of new materials, perhaps, with the old methods would improve that system. But it wouldn't really basically change it. It would be as efficient as it ever was. It would just perhaps be a little easier to keep up. Things like that. I don't think he's even talked to the Shah about it, but we fantasize this institute one, in which the Westerners would come to learn from the Middle Easterners and vice versa. That is, exchange ideas, not us tell them what to do. Yeah.
I can't resist saying that in some labor intensive systems, a little danger enhances the whole process because of the pride that goes with it.
Yeah.
Came as news to me that the poor farmers, the poor miners in Kentucky and all these places, everybody spends a lot of time feeling sorry for, are enormously proud individuals.
Yeah.
And you know, most of us would like to be as good as them, really, to get to know. That changes the sign of a lot of the kind of outside liberal idea of what's good.
Yes. That's again where our humility has to come in. In fact, these tunnels, you see, that was my Western reaction to these marvelous tunnels in Iran. They're called kanats, and they're maintained by a group of people called mukanis. And these people have the highest status of anybody in the village. They also have the lowest lifetime. They're likely, very likely, to be buried in a tunnel collapse, and everybody knows that. And nobody will ever, ever say an unkind word to a mukani, because they know they may not be around long. They know that the very life of the village depends on these people going and doing that dangerous job. And they're really a separate sector in society, very proud, goes through the families, this trade. And maybe on looking at that system, we would decide not to change it. Yeah.
So I read that our longest lived people come from places like the Ozarks, because you eat less when you're young, you tend to live longer.
And you work hard.
One thing I was going to mention, that you weren't here, since we were talking, I started out talking about right livelihood. That also implies wrong livelihood. There's such a thing as wrong livelihood. And right livelihood also means you don't turn over your decisions or values to a system like the marketplace or a self-correcting system. That any self-correcting system, if you call such a thing, exists within the framework of values, including your own immune system. Your own immune system, antibody and all that, exists within your values.
Mm-hmm.
And your framework of values affects how that works. So anyway, in terms of right livelihood, you can't say, let's depend on the marketplace to adjust.
Yeah. Or perhaps you could design a self-controlling system after you had specified the goal, and then design a system to maintain that goal. But the goal is that societally or humanly determined.
Right. It's not very clear when somebody's cleaning their house that you don't turn, your house isn't clean by laissez faire.
Yeah. Amen.
But this question of sort of the relationship between the marketplace and the right livelihood isn't quite that straightforward, because, you know, to the extent that one lives, anyone, whether he's living right or wrong, whatever your criteria may be, lives in a, not in the real world, but in an informational environment, some of which is genetic, of course, and evolves slowly, but a lot of which is perceptual, put it through your senses. And, you know, there's no objective set of information. That information comes to you through a whole set of processes. Some of them are physically determined, but a lot of them are culturally determined. And, you know, no right living person has the ability to get outside the marketplace, because it is, much of the information that we have to depend on is generated through the process of negotiation of some sort. It may be a capitalistic system, maybe some other sort. So what we're really talking about is not an absolute distinction there, but in a sense, where the weight of judgment lies.
Right. And how much you bend the tool of the marketplace.
How much weight you assign to the signals from the marketplace, right, versus the signals that are generated by the other kinds of equally artificial or synthetic types of information sources.
Right.
The pure, wrong living economist looks only at price and says, if the price goes up, I should produce more. If the price goes down, I should produce less. If I have something, whoever gives me the highest price, he's the one who deserves to have this. You know, presumably, a good, right-living individual would look less at the price than other things like equity and justice and so forth. But you know, there is not this distinction. Anyone who's right-living is certainly going to be influenced by the price.
Yeah, and in fact, some policies which I didn't mention.
Cost to things.
Sure. There are policies I didn't mention with regard to the marketplace. That is, I don't think it should be eliminated. It's a useful information system. It just should be made a useful information system and not the dominant god of the society, which it is in our society. I do think there, as long as you keep it away from its walls so that it works, I think it's worth maintaining.
Thank you for listening to the Lindisfarne Tapes. This podcast is brought to you by the Schumacher Center for a New Economics. For over 40 years, the mission of the Schumacher Center has been to envision the elements of a just and regenerative global economy, apply these elements in our home region in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts, and then develop the educational programs to share our results more broadly. To learn more about our work, visit our website at www.centerforneweconomics.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram. For more podcast content, check out our Schumacher Lectures podcast. To help strengthen our mission, you can make a donation at www.centerforneweconomics.org/donate.